Hello. I hope you're settling into a term which, if it can't exactly be called normal, can be called educational. For those who are in New York City, we are enjoying that last wave of warm weather as the North Atlantic settles down into a seasonal transition, which surprised very much the first Europeans to inhabit these parts. They weren't accustomed to warm weather at the end of September, although now everybody in the Northern Hemisphere will become extremely accustomed to it, or rather accustomed to extremes of it. So the English people called it Indian summer, which really meant that it was the time to get the last of the corn and the squash in. The spot that we occupy, that warm spot at the beginning of the winter, is unfortunately also likely to be our last gasp of relative health before the very difficult time that lies ahead of Americans sets in. Those of you who are hoping that you can do something to lessen the pain of this coming period, the best thing that you can do is be sure that you have plans to vote. If you can vote in this society, you should know exactly how and exactly when and lay your preparations for doing so. There is no vaccine for the virus, and despite all the happy talk, we cannot be sure that there will ever be a vaccine for the virus. But for the rest of what ails us, there is a powerful injection, and it is the vote. Let me spend a moment on the bits of housekeeping that we need to undertake. I'm hopeful that everybody who wants in-person instruction will have signed up for a meeting in Riverside Park this coming week. If you have not, the sign-up sheet is still there, and you could be listening to this, I hope, in time to make the Thursday and Friday meetings, if not the Monday one. As soon as we have come to a stable understanding of what is the most convenient times for meeting the people who are in town, I will then proceed in the principle of equality to set up slots during the week for small conference call sessions among groups of us who are not local, or at any rate, you who are not local, and me still clinging as much as possible to my apartment. And so we will have through the week a number of opportunities for small group meetings in addition to the other modalities of virtual instruction which we use here. I was contacted this week by representatives of a union of public university faculty members from a state in the United States whose public university faculty are unionized, seeking advice about whether it is healthy to be dependent in higher education upon a data mining, advertising, selling platform like Zoom with all of its difficulties, and what, if any, free software alternatives there might be. The union also wishes to discuss the proprietary student surveillance system with a side hustle in curriculum delivery called Canvas, which they are also growing a little bit concerned about under the conditions of the epidemic. As you know, because I forced you to read them, these matters had been on my mind too in the last several weeks. The difference between knowing what the alternatives are and hoping that there are some is the difference between freedom and the wish for freedom. And as we go today through our substantive business, I'm sure we will find ourselves thinking about that. But right now, in our modalities, without the intervention of any third party, because nobody is learning anything about the learning you are doing by being inside our software. Indeed, anybody hacking their way into our learning system is, well, I mean, they would be considered to be good at their jobs. They're not 12-year-olds in St. Petersburg. They are, well, I don't know who they are, because at least to the best of my knowledge, there aren't any, and I am making them fight on a small terrain if they want it. But one thing is for sure, they are not commercial data miners. They are state actors. There are, unfortunately, state actors that might consider it desirable to hear what we have to say to one another, to read what you write and to carry on about it, but unless it's marked public in our system, good luck to them. The writing that you do in this course by way of your essays could be either public or private. I have given you the power to control that for yourselves, and you can always just ask me and I will help you use it. I would hope that the work that we are doing writing for one another is also work that we would be prepared for other people in the world to read under most circumstances. And so, unlike your journals, which default to private, your essays will default to public, and you can change it with a single keystroke. Those essays, we have discussed a schedule for, and I'd like to get more specific now. I hope that I could see a first draft of your first essay by the close of business on Friday, 9 October. That's the best compromise that I can strike between giving me time to edit and you time to revise and write another piece and revise that one, and the natural desire on everybody's part to put it off as long as possible. So as long as possible is close of business Friday, October 9. And now let us spend a moment on the question of what it means to draft an essay for this offering, or indeed for many purposes in life. The goal of writing an essay of 1,000 words, whether it is an op-ed piece in a major market newspaper, or it's a note of advocacy to a professional organization, a legislator, or to begin the process of writing any longer document, a brief, an article. The goal of a unit of language of 1,000 words is to convey an idea. The purpose of such an essay in this offering is to convey an idea of yours about something related to the topics we are considering, and ultimately related to politics, technology, and law. Like any other analytic effort in this area, as I say, you should assume that it stands on the three legs of politics, technology, and law. There's no other leg upon which it can, in that sense, stand, and two is not enough. Three is always really required. We don't understand the phenomena we are studying here if we do not understand them technically, if we do not understand them as political struggles over power, usually over who controls one or more of the switches, and if we do not therefore understand that that struggle over power is mediated both by the technology of digital communications and by law. So, an idea of yours about something related to this course, ultimately destined to touch upon technology, politics, and law. The only other thing I wish to unpack is the phrase, an idea of yours. An idea of yours means, among other things, not an idea of mine. There isn't anything to be gained in this course by expatiating on my ideas. It is certainly possible to explain why I have done a poor job explaining my ideas, or why I haven't clarified my ideas, or what the unanticipated or unperceived internal contradictions of my ideas that is unperceived by me may be. It is certainly fine to have an idea of yours in relation to an idea of mine. Indeed, I would hope that my ideas are useful in that sense, that they constitute a jumping off point for ideas of yours. But there is no benefit, intellectual or professional, or for that matter, evaluatable. There is no benefit derived in simply telling me what I think. No points are gained by towing here the party line, whether the party line is mine or the line of some other party. It is not useful. What is useful is for us, you, me, and hopefully our reading colleagues too, to understand things better because we understand something you have thought. I do not mean, the way law review editors think they mean, that your idea is, quote, original, close quote. There aren't any of those, not really. 7 billion brains containing 7 billion minds and God knows how many identity states, let's say 49 billion just as a rough approximation, personality states, thinking in the world at present and having been thinking in the world of centuries and millennia before us mean that we are, as the author of the Hebrew poem we know as Ecclesiastes understood, we are not new under the sun. The consequence is, of course, that the ideas we have are other people's ideas too. I write sometimes in the form that involves me in exposing what we could call the anxiety of influence or the presence of intergenerational partnership. When I write with Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, I use their words, not for the purpose of pretending that they are mine, but from the perspective that in the long run they are ours. And it is certainly the case that your ideas, like my ideas, therefore owe a lot to all the others who have thought about the things that are absorbing you. We are not implying a test of uniqueness to your ideas. We are dependent, however, upon their freshness, upon their spontaneous quality of inception and growth. Because they are ideas in your mind, they are different, and they participate in the process of understanding other things in order to make your own, which is the theme of Ezra Pound in his ABC of reading. Make it new every day. Make it new. So this then is a call for an idea of yours that is you and therefore new because yours, because occurring in your mind with your experience in relation to the world as you see it and available for you to put your own words to it, not more than 1,000 of them. In 1,000 words, there is not room for the smallest particle of bullshit, and you should make sure you don't include any. In 1,000 words, there is no room for careless division of thinking, or for poor sequencing, or indeed for most of the other things that go wrong with our writing, which is why it is always best to begin writing what we are writing in sequences of 1,000 words, each of which is too small and too transparent to contain any bullshit, and in which the rigor of getting from the beginning to the end is too rigorous to allow for circumlocution and excess and mere decoration and chest beating and all the other things that can go wrong when we write long and which are foreshortened when we write short. An idea, yours, in 1,000 words. So how does one produce your idea in 1,000 words? The first thing that one does is to state the idea. Anything in 1,000 words can be made and probably can be analyzed, probably from the point of view of the editor of those thousand words, that's me for the moment, probably could be and should be analyzed by reducing it to the sentence that states in the clearest, simplest, and therefore no doubt oversimplified fashion the idea itself. To state the theme of it is to know from the beginning what you are writing. It occupies the beginning of the outline. And of course, there must be an outline. The most self-confident and wordy of us, and if you force me, I'll plead guilty to both, but the most self-confident and wordy of us may actually think that we can write 100,000 words without so much as the beginning of an outline, but you can't do that in 1,000, which is, again, another reason to appreciate the value of the form. In order to write 1,000 words well about an idea, you need to know exactly what each of those 1,000 words is doing there. Organization and sequence, therefore, has to be provided by an outline, and you need one. There should be physically a document, a set of points, indented or not, as you may care, and outlined in whatever way of, you know, orthography and placement and formatting on the page you want. But there should be an outline, a thing that tells you what the sequence of ideas within your idea is and what the orderly transition from one to another will be. That prevents you from using words like concrete to lay the road, just spread it out along the landscape. That's not the way an outlined object works. An outlined object is a three-dimensional map. It knows the contour of what it's doing, and it understands the order, and if you jumble it up the least little bit, you will feel immediately with the fingertips of your writing mind that something is out of place. The template that I will offer you when you form the essay, which you can do by clicking, as you'll see in the due course, the template for an essay assumes an outline and assumes that that outline can be recapitulated in the headings of the essay draft itself. This is helpful to all of us. It helps you to have the outline included as headings in your draft because it keeps you tied tightly to your chart, and it helps me because I know what the chart is. Editing is always in part about trying to figure out how something can be put more cleanly, more simply, and in better order. An optimal outline tells me that you've done that work instead of me. But sooner or later, we must do it all. So, what passes for an essay begins from an atom, and the atom is a sentence, and the sentence conveys an idea. And in the first paragraph of an essay, there is a sentence that says what this is about and gives the reader a reason to keep reading. Once that sentence has been put into an introductory paragraph of that essay, then you can say about the idea you have just expressed, how you came by it, and what its full, finer points may be, and how that idea can be distinguished from other ideas to which it's close, and in which some objections can be anticipated or some questions answered. That's the body of the next 700 words, let's say, followed by some conclusion which both restates and expands upon your idea as it was stated first, and which gives the reader something she can do to take the matter on further on her own, to use your idea to build upon as you used whatever it was that was the material from which you started. So then that's where we are. That's the job of making an essay, and you can see why it only gets better as we reheat it. Why, like any other stew composed of that which you had and that which you thought up, editing, pressing on the pieces, why is this word here? What does this sentence do? How does this sequence present the best of what you want, editing is what turns from draft to draft an essay that knew the music it had in mind to one that really sings it. And that's our job, mine, yours, anybody else who wants to get involved on the wiki. The job is to explain how we can make it better. The editor's job is your success, but most writers, even professional writers, respond to editing with mixes of emotions, not all of which are gratitude. When we write, we endow what we have written with the sense of risk we felt in it, risk that it wouldn't be good enough, risk that it would embarrass us, risk that we wouldn't be understood, or that we would be laughed at or rejected or otherwise made unhappy about our work. And so we have a tendency to defend our work the way we defend our bodily integrity, even though we know that in fact we are only in danger of improving what we've done. But even professional writers, seasoned writers, writers who write every day for editorial intervention and publication, have been known to respond to things as though what they were going through was not an effort at improvement, but an assault. I understand the pain of being edited. I've suffered from it myself. I wrote for years, from time to time, for the magazine of opinion called The Nation, not because of the lavish fees it paid me. Victor Navasky suffered a lifetime of effective satire from really excellent writers, including Calvin Trillin in verse, lambasting him for how little he paid, and all those writers were paid more by Navasky than I was paid. But I wrote for The Nation not for the money or the exposure, which is negligible, having, as it does, six really good readers. I wrote for The Nation because there, my editor, Karen Rothmeyer, was the finest editor I ever worked with. And because I didn't even get 1,000 words in The Nation most of the time, I got 750. And Karen made every single one of those words declare its purpose and its benefit, and because she did that, they changed, and every time they changed, they got better. And I can say, no matter how much I wished that some of my favorite sentences hadn't been dismembered and reconstituted on the table, I can say that Karen made my writing better for the rest of my life every single time I hit the keys. Now, I can't promise to be that good an editor, but I can say that I've worked hard at it the way I worked hard to be edited, and I will do my best. I will step on your toes, I fear, from time to time, but trust me, it's unintentional, and if you call it out, I'll apologize about it, even when I think I was still very right. The goal is to make your writing better and to make you a better writer. That is the goal, and I am trying to work towards it, no matter how ineptly at any given moment, at any given sentence, I may be at doing it. That is my effort. I will not change your words. I will comment upon them. Your words are your job. The writing is your writing. What you want to do is what you will do, and in the end, I will have nothing but the resources of pitiful and inadequate judgment, which, because it is called a grade, is thought of as though it were really very good judgment and highly powerful, but it's nothing of the kind. At any rate, our goal is to make what you write better, and therefore to help clarify and make stronger your idea. That's the purpose of this. The rest of it is merely bureaucracy and bullshit. All right. We will have much more time to talk about, and more importantly, to write about your writing, but that's sufficient for this beginning of the week before. I will talk with you about ideas. If you come and say, I'm thinking about writing about this and that in your journal, in a meeting, on the pad while class is going on. I will listen and I will try and be helpful, but you understand I don't choose your topic. That's your responsibility. I will not say yes. I will not say no. You may dig wherever you wish, and if there is gold in the ground, it's yours, and if there isn't, that's yours too. So let us turn our attention from the mechanism to the matter, if we might. I say, we have built an extraskeletal nervous system now embracing almost the whole of the human race, and soon, from cradle to grave, to be integrated into the construction of the human mind at every turn, from its beginning to its end. That extraskeletal nervous system, which we call in brief the net, was originally made for purposes which oddly overlapped between the most disciplined and military and the most undisciplined and speculative parts of the United States society, which was then and will for another microsecond be the richest and most sophisticated of the societies that emerged from the crucible of the Second World War. That extraskeletal nervous system has been changed, not in its fundamental anatomic properties, but in its physiology, in the mechanism of its operation, through a series of changes, the history of which I've lived through and observed and made efforts to change in the course of the last 45 years. And its current drift is deeply disappointing and threatening to the concepts of good human society that I most cared about and that I provided what little energy and thoughtfulness I had to trying to effect in the course of my grown-up life. The anatomy of this net, as I have indicated, is basically a form of networked communication depending upon two different moving parts: the pipes that carry signals from one place to another, the wires, cables, microwave links, millimeter radio wave structures, and the string between the two tin cans. Those are the pipes. The business of moving bits is a complicated and effective business. We have all sorts of what we are pleased to call telecommunications in our world. We exploit the shared resource of the electromagnetic spectrum in many different ways, different technologies, different politics, and different law. But pipes are pipes. They don't change what passes through them. The other anatomic structure, the other cellular basic of the system, is the switch, a digital computer almost always, which decides with respect to what goes down the pipes, where and when and for whom and on what terms and on what prices and subject to what conditions, switches thereby determine the flow in that nervous system as individual neurons in our inward system determine what moves down the axons and travels across those electrochemical gaps where the forms of cholinesterase and other chemicals allow a little spark from one place to another. Just as in the brains of higher animals, higher meaning, of course, really, really sophisticated, like crows, or really kind of basic, like, you know, human beings. In animals, the neurology that makes mind is based upon different, convergently evolved structures of neurons into stacks. Systems that use multiple neurons firing in sequence to accomplish the tasks of amplifying and modifying and reconsidering by relooping signals that emerge from the sensory organs and the interoception of the body itself, and which creates in that mind, which is the outgrowth of the brain, a sense of self and the outer world. Those pipes and switches then are neurologically, geometrically, technically connected in large arrays, the mere geometry of which has its own effect. That you have in your apartment chosen to use a pipe consisting of an 802.11 radio signal, maybe A, maybe N, maybe G, but at any rate, some radio signal subject to a protocol of common signaling rules, how frames are assembled and packets are stuffed into the frames and frames are stuffed into the electromagnetic spectrum, that you in your apartment have done this is of course subject to the possibility that somebody in the next apartment is trying to use the same radio frequencies in the same way, and your devices have a limited intellectual ability to resist those interferences. Though, as you may have read in one Welsh town, a single malfunctioning television set of an old tubey kind could produce enough electromagnetic interference to mess up an entire town's broadband connections. But allowing for the presence of these sorts of minor pathologies, tumors, and failures of transmission and technological difficulties, the physiology of the pipes is fairly straightforward. They must carry a known volume of signals across a known distance in known time, and they must do that in ways which allow for correction of error, or at least detection of error, and retrying and re-handshaking to make sure everything is tied up together properly, which happens both at the connection layer of the net and one layer above, where packets are moved around and their receipt or non-receipt is correctly registered and everything gets sorted out, and all the jigsaw puzzle pieces that we throw at megabit or even terabit levels through the net are correctly turned back into the signals upon which our digital minds can work, and ultimately our organic minds can be both informed and misinformed, sometimes simultaneously. But how switches behave determines the physiology of the network as a whole, how it functions, who gets what, and when they get it, and why they get it, and what they have to pay for it, and what degrees of surveillance or freedom are involved, and what conditions may be placed upon what they do with things next. All of that physiology is in the switches, and it is that over which our politics fights. The physiological structure of the network, above the layer of its anatomy, is the creation of software. Digital computers run programs. Programs determine what happens to the data they see as packets, where they go and how they go and how fast they move and who pays for them, and all the rest of it is determined by the software, which also turns one kind of signal into another, which remembers, which judges, which invokes, which initiates, which refuses, which destroys. All of that is the outcome of software. At the very beginning of this process, before I was a kid, but after there were computers worked on by people I worked with when I wasn't a kid anymore, at the beginning of this process, the relationship between software and hardware was hard to see. Initially, the digital computers we built during and after the Second World War were programmed by putting physical cables into places and changing how signals flowed by flipping switches. The first computers I ever worked with as hardware were programmed by flipping bits on the front panel, switches up and down, toggling the individual machine language into the machine, checking when you flipped the switch that you had thrown a 0 into a 1 correctly through some process that was exogenous to the computer itself. Software was the condition of the hardware. But of course, that's not what software was meant to be. Software was meant to be signals of their own symbolic kind. Computer programs are written for two purposes. One, so that computers can execute them, and two, so that human beings can read them, understand them, learn from them, fix them, maintain them, improve them, and adapt them to circumstances. All of which, from a priority point of view now, and from a distinct and functional differentiation at the beginning, was the work of humans. Humans make software, machines merely carry it out. That's not a firm distinction in the world, in the same way that the distinction between software and hardware is not a firm distinction. We have indeed an unfirm substance we call firmware, which is software is so tightly integrated at the lowest level into the machine, maybe because it sits on a read-only memory chip in the bowels of the processor's surroundings, or maybe for some other reason, so closely tied to the machine that it isn't soft anymore and it's not quite hard, and so we call it firmware. But what we really mean is that that distinction between the genotype and the phenotype of the organism in its running is not quite so simple as it looks. Nonetheless, it still makes sense to think of software primarily as things produced by humans in order to change the behavior of computers and in order to teach and endow human beings with further power over the computers in which the software runs. But once we are a superorganism, not merely individual human beings, but human beings in society, not merely in society the way we always were, but now in society in a new way, a way generated by the interaction with the nervous system in which we have wrapped ourselves, software is also power. Software is the physiology of the network expressed symbolically and becoming rules. As my dear friend and colleague Larry Lessig said in his first great book, Code, code is law. By which what Larry meant was that the operation of the network comes to control and regulate and make society function in a particular fashion, much as it is the desire of the symbolic substance we call law to do the same, to structure our interactions and to establish how our society works. Software says that it is possible to receive a file from anywhere in the net if you have its uniform resource locator, URL, a thing that begins with a protocol by which you request it, let us say HTTPS or HTTP, colon, and a couple of slashes, and then the name of the computer where the material is apparently at rest, or at any rate which knows how to find it, slash, some further designation within a file system hierarchy of the location of that information, HTTP, colon, two slashes, moglen.law.columbia.edu, a particular machine, canonically named old.law.columbia.edu, named in the IP world as 128.59.177.251, but for the moment to be known as moglen.law.columbia.edu, to be addressed by HTTP, that is, at its port number 80, off the base of its web hierarchy in the wiki/lawnetsoc/webhome, or something like it, .txt, but you don't need the .txt because the wiki servicer will actually turn that URI into /twiki/bin/view, that is, run the view program on the port of the wiki that you can find in lawnetsoc/webhome, which will involve the construction first of a security model. Are you allowed to get that file? That's the access control in our web, followed by the actual transmission of the data to your computer, where it will be eaten by a thing called a browser that will use the code embedded in the file that has been given to it, which is written in the language HTML, to decide how to put it forward to your eye. How to assemble the sidebar and the top bar and the material and the typeface and its size and the relations of objects on the page to one another, and in the end, you see something. which you think of as the internet and which one might think of as the web, but which is actually the version of that file that at that moment was assembled for you. It's not a static entity. In theory, more than just the security model could be at stake. When two people see what they think of as the same Facebook page, they don't see the same page at all. The advertising layer was constructed by auctions conducted hundreds of thousands of times a minute to determine who sees which advertisements and to allow those advertisements to flow through to your browser on the basis of URLs provided by Facebook to your browser, just yours, because somebody paid for the right to send you that ad at that moment. But all sorts of other things have also been dynamically constructed for you, including the news feed and what's the priorities and how they look and what you see first and what you have to scroll a little further for, and indeed, therefore, what your experience of the world may be. Because the intervening physiology, the activity of assembling what you get, the activity of the parasite with the mind of God that knows exactly what you were looking for 47 minutes ago and 43 minutes ago and 41 minutes ago and what you've clicked on recently and what you always buy and who you always talk to and also what everybody wants these days and how is the Trump campaign trying to re-elect the President of the United States and what is human attention like these days in the condition of the epidemic, at home, with the kid, all of that in the mind of the parasite, which is a software construction, changing how the world looks to you. I have to admit, I don't much like the film, The Social Dilemma, that I asked you to watch. It annoys me in many different ways. Jaron Lanier always annoys me, whether he's on my side or he's on the other side, and he has been on both over the course of time. He always annoys me. And even though Shoshana Zuboff is a hero in the film, as she is a hero to me in the world of thought, I do not think they understand what parts of their interview with her to use. But what is really, I must say, as I think of it, the most important part of The Social Dilemma is the beginning. By the time we are in our first aerial shot over upper middle class suburban America, we have already, from my point of view, sustained the most important information that it has for us, which is the presentation of all of these talented, technically adept, hard-charging, wonderful capitalist people, all of whom know that there is a really serious problem, but when you ask them what the problem is, they cannot tell you. The Social Dilemma is really, after all, a story of Faust. How clever he was, how technically adept, how wonderfully inventive, how completely a force of innovation was Faust before he met Mephistopheles and made his bargain. It's really about how you never look the devil in the eye when you are dealing with him, because money is a psychoactive substance, and so is the power of creation, and so is love and sex, and so is the trust that you have gained from human beings, which you did not earn. That moment, which, not depicted in this film, but in another film about Mark Zuckerberg, is the moment when at Harvard he says, "These fools, they trust me." The Social Dilemma is a film about the problem, but what is most available from the very beginning is how difficult it is for these people to explain what the problem is. I hope that even though we've only been together in this non-together sort of way of ours for a couple of weeks, I have at least served you already sufficiently as to have explained to you how to name the problem. Most of the next 11 weeks that we spend together will be about less the naming of the problem. It has a name. It's the parasite with the mind of God. That's about naming the solution, which has also got some simple names, but the names are only simple in relation to the explanations we are about to try to undertake. When I first became interested in software, I was 12. And the reason I was interested in software was that there was a machine that could talk to me. Its mode of discussion was a thunkish one, consisting of 10 characters per second thunked out on a teletype. Thunk, 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 boom, thunk, 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 and so on, as a little rotating cylinder with type on it pressed against a ribbon, which pressed against a page, which unrolled like a towel from a spool in a system that had come into existence in the middle of the 20th century and was now being employed like a kind of ghost-driven electric typewriter to allow a conversation between a boy and a machine. And from the first moment that that boy communicated with that machine through the thunkishness of the teletype, he was hooked. And I became what I recognized later when first I read Joseph Weizenbaum's Computer Power and Human Reason, and met there the character I had become without ever knowing it, the compulsive programmer. And so from 12 I was. If I had to take a train across the city and crawl up through a heating duct into a locked building in the middle of a Saturday morning in order to pull a bag full of stuff off my shoulder and begin replacing the parts on the teletype which the math teacher, Mr. Alcock, had taken home for the weekend to discourage his students from coming in on the weekend to break into the building to use the computer, well, then that's what I did, because that's what compulsion is like. And so from the beginning, my fascination was with the fact that the human being and the machine were communicating with one another in some language, call it BASIC, as it was. But the mystery of that linguistic connection between the human being and the machine was where my mind concentrated. And although compulsively programming, I started with very simple things like times tables and the analysis of compound fractions. Of course, in the end, what I really wanted to do was to investigate that language between the human and the machine. And in due course, as I got skilled, that's what I worked on. I worked on programming language. I worked on how to make software, not in the sense of how to build it or test it or install it or maintain it, though I had to do all those things. I worked on how to make software in the sense that I worked on what it was that were the languages that human beings and machines should use to communicate with one another, which began from two fundamental propositions. One, that human beings and computers think differently, and their languages have to cross not merely a cultural but a fundamental intellectual type boundary. And that whatever it is that mediates the way computers and human beings talk to one another, it contains so much power that it can either build up or destroy the nature of what it is to be a human being. I knew that at the beginning. When I was 15, I said to my father, "In the 21st century, there will be two kinds of human beings. Those who know how to change the behavior of computers, and those who don't. And those who don't will be the slaves of those who do." That was what I thought when I was still that boy, not 12, but 15, just as incapable of pretty much everything, just beginning to learn about a few things in the world like money and sex and so on, but already endowed with an insight which I fear we spent an awful lot of the subsequent generation trying to eliminate again. Which is that in the root of software is the root of power. The Latin proverb says, "Cupiditas radix malorum est." The love of money is the root of all evil. And Latin, at least not as the Romans spoke it, but Latin doesn't contain a proverb for the other point, which is that the making of software is the root of all power. Facebook is a contrivance about how to give people a website. Facebook is a system for determining how you can share things easily. And of course, it isn't just Facebook, because it's also Instagram, because it's also WhatsApp, because they're just systems for using computer networks to perform the task of giving people ways to communicate with one another, to share a photo, a piece of music, a bit of news, some gossip, a quelling over one's children, a beautiful view of one's idyllic vacation on which one couldn't stop fighting with one's spouse, but that's not what it looks like on the tube. Facebook is a network of technological contrivances designed to make stuff that everybody wants to do perfectly surveillable. And all of that is because the software gives you the opportunity to feel like you are constructing something. We have moved from constructing a website to constructing a career as an Instagram influencer. But ultimately, all we mean is that the modalities of sharing in the network have been tied to a structure in which you feel, as individuals, that you are creating, and the system feels that you are meat on the microscope stage. That everything you do and everything that is done around you and everything that is done because of what is done by you and by those around you is captured and studied and known. The platform called Amazon tries to understand all of your thinking and feeling and ideation in relation to the physical material objects in the economy that it buys, sells, and moves. And as I said in the Berlin Q&A with which we began this semester, we can see the forms of emotional, quote, engagement, close quote, that each of the other platform components creates, the enormous outlet for aggression that is Twitter, and the forms of material envy that are generated by Facebook and its Instagram componentry, and the forms of the sense of going down the rabbit hole and learning and researching that is QAnon in all the various places where it lurks, and all the conspiracies like it that give people a feeling of being in on the secret, and all the ones that harness greed and so on, and I don't need to take you through lust and pride, but you know they're there. And you see how it is that the physiology of the network, mediated by its software, has come to be about the process of integrating human beings through their emotions, through their reflexes, through their desires into a biological structure larger than themselves and operated for not their benefit. You don't know what it's like to be an ant in an anthill, of course. But no 19th century human being ever understood what it is like to be a 21st century social media adept child either. We are becoming different. We are becoming sufficiently different because of the physiology of the network that embraces us, that soon it will not be possible to know what it meant not to be what we will then be. Hence, I asked you to read for this week a little piece, the part zero of my book in progress, to clarify the nature of those stakes. What would it mean, then, to ask what are the choices involved in the physiology of the network? Does social media have to be like that, or could it be like something else? How would it be like something else, and what rules would we have in the world, both rules of computer programming and rules of law and politics that would have made it something else? Here, a generation ago, when I instead of you were young, there were a few of us who wanted to get to the bottom of that question. The world was very small then of people who dealt with software. A few tens of thousands of people in the world were professionals. Soon it would be a few hundred thousand, then millions, now tens of millions. But those orders of magnitude of increase didn't necessarily make the problems clearer. They may have made them less clear. They certainly made them more complex by adding to the number of minds and motives that were involved. And so, in the context of what we knew about computers and about software, and in the context of the science fiction which taught us about the unintended consequences of technological decisions, and living as we did under the threat of 22 minutes to human annihilation through the exchange of nuclear weapons from submarines and bombers and missile silos located across the Northern Hemisphere, in that world, when at 15 I thought that slavery for some and too much power for others came to rest on who knew about changing the behavior of computers, in that world we began to converge on principles about software. Ultimately, the question that determines the fate of human freedom is, like all the other questions that have determined the fate of human freedom since we invented the idea of human freedom a few geological microseconds ago, ultimately the fate of human freedom depends upon what we understand to be our rights. This is a complicated question. Greek people living on the north edge of the Mediterranean Sea 2,500 years ago had ideas about that, and they weren't quite the ones that they learned from the Egyptians or from the Phoenicians who taught them, whoever they, these weird Dorian Greeks, may have been. But whatever it was they thought about rights, but their rights didn't prevent them from also seeing slavery as just the way it works, and the inadequacy of men and being superior to the inadequacy of women as the way it works, and the superiority of the rich to the poor, and even their great thinking on the subject is, you know, dubious, just as Jaron Lanier's great thinking about human freedom now is, let me put it gently, dubious too. But one thing that we understood as kids, as we started out on the journey that leads to the present mess, one thing that we understood is that users, that is the human beings at the end of the network, the ones where computers present them with a view of reality that they then subscribe to, users must have rights. In order to achieve freedom of any kind in a world in which those who know how to change the behavior of computers have power, the way that that behavior of computers is determined must begin from the idea of users' rights. I know that you think that when you are offered, click here, read the terms and conditions, and say you agree in order to use this wonderful new service I am promoting at you, that that represents rights, but it doesn't really. You're all lawyers, and you know that when a thing is called a right, it is often a duty instead, because Hofeldian calculus is not taught in first grade. And most human beings don't really ever understand what the relationship between rights or duties are, or how to know whether what you possess is a power or an immunity. But you do know that when it says, click here to accept the terms and conditions in order to use this amazing, wonderful service, that whatever rights you are being given are synthetic, and they were cooked up by the guy on the other side who is offering you a take-it-or-leave-it chance to accept the rights you're given, not the rights you need or the rights guaranteed to you in any constitution or system of legal fairness evolved over generations, just something. Click here, say yes, receive the rights we find it convenient to offer you. And that, of course, isn't what we mean at all. Political rights, which are often actually, after all, immunities, that is, the power not to be involved in legal arrangements proposed by third parties for their benefit, rights in the system of the net for users must begin from understanding what the software which is interacting with you does. Not merely in some, oh, I have a wonderful service, it's so convenient, click here to say yes and you can start using it right now. But rather in the sense that you have to be able to understand exactly everything it does. You really have to be allowed to know what's going on in the same way that you really have to be allowed to know exactly how the doctor's going to cut you up and how they're going to sew you up when they're finished and what's going to come in between, what we call informed consent in the context of medical procedures. You really need to understand what's happening. Oh, but please, I don't want to understand. I just want it to be convenient. I just want to give my anxieties to the machine. I don't really want to know what it does. That may be true, but you want somebody to be able to find out. You want somebody to know exactly what the details are and why, as you want your doctor to know how the pills actually work. And how you, and as you want your lawyer to know how the system actually behaves when you trust it with your property, your family, your life, and your time. At the same time that you want to be able to know how things work, you don't want everything to know how you work. The richest of the people in the world have the most financial secrecy. As the most powerful in the world have the most personal privacy. It's true that if you're Jeff Bezos and you have more money than everybody else and you have more privacy than anybody else and you're still stupid enough to carry a smartphone and send dick pics to your girlfriend your wife doesn't know about, you're going to cause yourself some trouble sooner or later. Because, of course, there's nothing to prevent the rich and powerful from being stupid. But the expectation is that we will use our wealth and our power to protect ourselves and our people, our families, our loved ones, our allies first. And so, of course, there is a sphere of privacy. If you're an emperor, you live in a forbidden city. And the immensity of your wealth, which is the wealth of your sister-in-law and your first cousin and your father's uncle and the judo instructor you used to spar with and all those other, all of that lies behind a veil of opacity or semi-opacity, which is the work of power. And also what, in a world of equality, every human being should have, because there is a zone of dignity and separateness, which arises from that part of our life in society that we consider to be our own self. And however complex and ultimately incoherent the idea of the self may be, that doesn't prevent us from defending it completely or believing that it utterly matters. And to recognize that software is being constantly deployed to reduce the dignity and independence and selfness of self is to recognize that rights have disappeared into the course of the network. So, a long time ago, in the Stone Age, before the 21st century, and before the smartphone, and before Mr. Zuckerberg had done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age, there were a few young people, of whom I was, building software in the network that was just beginning to lay down the initial morphology of a few pipes and a few switches, worrying about how to secure users' rights. And when that boy was a newly hired law professor, having won the lottery and being able to flesh out for himself what he was going to do with his life besides teaching law, that was what I was thinking about in Oxford in the summer of 1988. What was the campaign going to be? And as I was thinking that, others were thinking that too. John Gilmore, whom I had worked with when I was 16 and he was 19, making email move across a network, and who had been the number five employee at Sun Microsystems, and who had come to understand that servicing free software was going to be a way of making money. And our senior preceptor, Richard Stallman, beginning to think about freedom and software and free software as a way of securing freedom for the users of software. And, well, lots of other people whom we all knew together who were people floating in our world, but the world hadn't come to be yet, and the thing that concerned us, the fate of freedom, the nature of rights, was an open subject we could think about. And of course, because we thought about software, because we knew that software was the center of the question, we were thinking about software. How to make it, but most importantly, how to secure users' rights in it. And securing users' rights in it meant securing their right to know how it worked. Of course, this is a political idea, but in the end, it turns out to be about the law. But what is the law of software? In the period we are talking about, when I, at 15 in 1974, was saying to my father that software would ultimately make some people slaves to other people. When in 75, Gilmore and I were working on networked email distribution, when, well, any of those whens, it wasn't even clear what the law of software was. Was software a stuff protected by copyright? Works of authorship? Was software stuff protected by patent? Was it ideas for which the state had granted practical monopolies over use and exploitation of an irrefragable kind, prohibiting independent reinvention for a lengthy period? Was software something all its own that wasn't subject to either? Nobody knew. It wasn't until 1979 that the Cantu Commission in the United States even formally began as a precedent to legislation to gather wise old graybeards to figure it out. And by the time we knew what it was, by the time we had at least temporarily decided that patenting wasn't really what software was subject to any more than mathematics was, though we changed our minds about that and are now changing it back. And even before we understood how software might be incorporated into patent law, let alone actually having taken the movement of copyright in the United States from the 1911 Act to the 1976 Act to beyond, even before the lawyers had settled or the legislators had written or the courts had thought about what it was that the lawyers thought about the legal structure for the rights in software, we were already trying to figure out how to use whatever the ultimate decision was to create some rights that would protect users of software from the runaway physiology of the network. But we weren't thinking that that's what we were thinking, because none of us was a lawyer yet. By the time one of us was a lawyer, among those many people, and some of us who weren't lawyers had gotten awfully interested in legal material, and John Gilmore had founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I had left the Supreme Court, and Richard Stallman had already invented GNU and come close to winning the MacArthur Prize for what he was thinking and all. And by the time all that had happened, we had already, each of us, evolved some forms of thinking about what users' rights in software would mean. We weren't really interested in the software. I mean, we were interested in the software business. All of us were one way or another related to the world of making software, and some of us had made a ton of money in it. But what we were really interested in was the political outcome, for which the technology and the law were merely conflicting roads leading, we hope, to the same place. And all we really wanted to do was to change the way software was made everywhere around the world in order to ensure that the way it was made would inherently protect freedom. And in the end, that turned out to be about copyright licensing. And it turned out to be about all rights reversed, the copy left on the software. And it turned out to be about convincing the largest and most powerful technology businesses in the world that software made that way, subject to the copy left, and giving source code to everybody, and was not only good for freedom, but that it would make them tons more money. And all that happened. We did all that. We created ways of making software, and we created ways of making law about software, and we did everything that we needed to change the way software was made in the world, and we succeeded. And then when it came to the political question, had we secured the rights of users? Well, we had failed. Over the next 3 weeks, we need to understand exactly what that story was and where the successes were and where they still are and why the failures happened and why we live in the mess we live in now. But in order to do that, we are actually reliving a process. Not a biography. It's not me. It's not Stallman. It's not Gilmore. It's not John Perry Barlow. It's not the king of the undead now dead. It's not Mr. Zuckerberg. It's not Dorsey. God knows it isn't Dorsey, and thank heavens it's not Jaron Lanier. It's none of us. It's not the bewildered multimillionaire monetizers and the out of control haters of human dignity. It's not Stephen P. Jobs with his contempt for the human race. It isn't that we must live the history of the people. That isn't boring. Sometimes it's rather interesting. How Sauron forged the Ring of Power and how he enslaved the men and made the ring wraiths is a good story for the fire on a winter evening. Or, I guess, for a movie maker in New Zealand. The story is really the story of how the idea of freedom failed us as we built the net. Even those of us who cared most about it, how it failed us. How we lost the forest for the trees. And how, of course, we sold the forest to the lumber companies. And the trees, all billions of them, went down before the storm. That's what we're thinking about. That's why we're thinking about it. That's why we meet by Grant's tomb in our masks, if we do, and on the phone, if we do, and never on Zoom. Talk to you soon.